Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Millions of Americans, including 2.4 million Ohioans, lack access to high-speed broadband internet. That means they either have no internet service or have only one provider option. Connected Nation Ohio is working to change that metric. Chris McGovern is Director of Research Development for Connected Nation. Welcome to the show.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me.
So what is Connected Nation? What's its stake in this?
Well, Connected Nation is a national nonprofit organization, and we work to promote broadband access, adoption, and usage. We started out mapping broadband coverage and where broadband was available, and from there we learned that access is very important, but if it's available and people aren't subscribing, then making it available isn't really helping. And we need to make sure that folks are using it as well as being able to get connected.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We are talking about the issue of access to broadband internet. My guest is Chris McGovern. He's Director of Research Development for Connected Nation. They're working to change the problem. 2.4 million Ohioans right now lack access to high-speed broadband internet. That means they have no internet service or have only one provider option. If you have a question or comment for Chris McGovern, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Chris, when we say broadband internet access, what do we mean? I mean, I said it's either you don't have any, or as far as access to it, or limited, or you only have one provider. What's the diff?
Well, when we're talking about access, we look at the people who actually have the option of subscribing. But what we've found, and studies have shown, is that when there isn't any competition, then a lot of times there's no push for providers to improve what they have or what they offer. And so a lot of times, even when people are connected or have access to the same types of platforms, if they don't have as many competitors in the area and consumers don't have as many choices, then it ends up that they end up with slower service or more expensive service, possibly.
And what Connected Nation Ohio is doing, well, first of all, before I get into what you're doing, why is it such an issue for Ohio? 2.4 million people, that's out of a population of roughly 8 million. What's the deal in Ohio?
Well, in terms of the number of households that have, or that are subscribing, Ohio ends up right about in the middle of the mix between all the states. It ranks about 23rd. And the people who aren't able to get it, they are primarily in rural areas. These are folks that typically, because of geographic issues or distances, providers don't have the there's not enough of a financial incentive for them to build out to a lot of these the more remote areas. So unfortunately, they end up getting left behind. And that, like I said, that's a lot of the rural areas, particularly in the Appalachian area.
Mm-hmm. You're doing a survey of people out there. What is it asking?
We are, yeah. It's an online survey at myconnectedcommunity.org.
Ironically, I might add. So.
All right, and so what, obviously with it being an online survey, we're not going to be focusing as much on who has or who doesn't have service. Mm-hmm. But what we talk about in that survey is more how people are using it. Are you using it to shop, to talk with your healthcare provider, to interact with your government offices? you know, there are all these services that are becoming more and more only available online. Mm. And so we want to talk to people about how they're using their services and, you know, if they're satisfied with services that they do have, because a lot of times even people who are connected, their service might be slower than they would like to have, or maybe, you know, they have customer service issues. You know, there are all of these things that just because a person has broadband at their household, it doesn't mean that everything is peaches and cream for them.
What could states actually do? You're saying that the providers lack the incentive to expand, you know, their services. What can states do to incentivize them then?
Well, several states are taking steps to promote improved access by making it easier for providers to lay out the infrastructure that's necessary, or to support low-cost broadband programs. Both at the state and the federal level, there are grants and loans that are being offered that will, in theory, help make it more affordable to build broadband out to these more remote areas, which will help all those millions of Ohioans who don't have access currently.
Is there evidence that this is working anywhere?
Sure. You know, right now, there are, you know, the number of households that don't have access, based on the current FCC definitions, is shrinking. Hmm. The only thing that we have to be careful about, though, is, you know, we are only talking about current definitions, which, according to the FCC, is internet service that's available at speeds of 25 megabits per second downstream and 3 megabits per second upstream.
All right, does that mean?
essentially, that means internet that's fast enough to reliably stream a video, you know, without it getting too ragged on you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, those speed definitions, though, as new technology comes up, as new applications arise, those speed requirements are going to increase. You know, people are going to need faster connections in order to do everything that they want to do. And so, you know, just because, you know, if we were to get everybody connected, you know, we wave a magic wand, everybody gets connected at the current definition, tomorrow there's going to be something new that is going to need faster service. And so it's going to be an ongoing process, both looking at making sure the speeds are available and making sure that the service is high enough quality.
Why doesn't satellite internet connection help in this realm?
Well, satellite service, you know, it is, but it's better than nothing, mm-hmm. of course. But there can be issues with satellite service. A lot of times there are data caps where if a person uses their internet service or you know uses up so much information over the course of the month, then their service may end up being throttled. There are weather issues and vegetation issues that can come into play when trying to get the satellite service. And so, you know, satellite internet has come a long way over the last few years. And there are there's definitely a lot of research being done to improve broadband service through internet or through satellite. Mm-hmm. But you know, a lot of times when you're comparing the speeds that are capable from fiber to satellite, it's really not much of a competition. Oftentimes, fiber is going to be the best choice.
How does Ohio stack up against other states when it comes to access, to broadband internet? I mean, that 2.4 million I mentioned, that's a big chunk of the population at this point. Are other states in the same kind of fix?
Depending on the state, you know, like I said, in terms of households that have fixed broadband connections, Ohio's right about there in the middle. It's ranked 23rd out of 50 states plus Puerto Rico. And it typically states that have more urban areas or states where more funding and more support has been put towards the broadband expansion, they tend to be at the higher end.
And what do we know about how the lack of access to broadband affects development in the areas where it's missing? I mean, business development, that kind of a thing. Is there anyone that's worked on the cost and the equation of that?
Oh, sure. There are some good studies that have come out from Ohio University,
mm-hmm.
that have talked about how the lack of broadband service affects households. There have been studies that have linked broadband access to higher home values, to higher high school graduation rates, to to a variety of benefits, both for residents and for businesses. Businesses, when they don't have the capability of getting connected, particularly small businesses, they're cut off from a lot of the market, and so when they don't have that service available to them, it can really cause a hindrance.
Chris McGovern, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
Hey, thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Chris McGovern is Director of Research Development for Connected Nation Ohio. They are working on getting broadband to the 2.4 million Ohioans that currently lack it. So we'll have more Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Computer-generated imagery, or CGI, has transformed the film industry since its inception in the 1973 film Westworld. CGI technology has captivated millions of moviegoers. But as more films use CGI, some question whether our society has left the movie magic behind. Scott Frankel is the Vice President of Technology at Avametric Gerber Technology, where he oversees 3D applications, research and development. He's a voting member of the Academy of Motion Pictures and Sciences, which votes on the Oscars. He also has more than 25 visual effects credits for movies such as Minority Report, The Matrix sequels, Planet of the Apes, Forrest Gump, and more. Welcome, Scott Frankel.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
When did CGI get to be sort of a mainstay in the film industry?
Wow, that's a great question. You mentioned Westworld. Westworld scared the crap out of me when I was a kid. It was a great film. The first all computer generated scene in a major motion picture that dates back to a Barry Levinson film from the mid '80s. Young Sherlock Holmes. Steven Spielberg was a producer and. If you or your guests have seen the film, it's a stained glass window and that depicts a knight in shining armor. and the knight sort of coalesces into an actual animated character and pulls himself away from that glass. And that's the first all CG visual effect shot in a major motion picture. Pretty exciting.
How would you say, at first when you said that the Westworld scared you as a child, yeah. I thought at first when you were saying that, I thought it scared you in the movie business. I mean, how did the film industry respond to this new technology and how did it change it?
Okay, well, so I'm old, but I'm not that old. I think that's a really interesting question. And I think one of the things that helps answer the question is the broad trajectory of graphics in film. So there have been visual effects in film for many, many years, or special effects as they were known in the day, that did not involve digital technologies and process shots like green screen photography, blue screen photography, or rear projection. There have been a number of manipulations that have been used since the very beginning of filmmaking. The transition to digital technologies, which we saw in films like Death Becomes Her or Terminator 2, and then obviously the first Jurassic Park movie of 1992, that really gave filmmakers just orders of magnitude more control over the medium, over their ability to actually tell the story that they want to tell. So before that time, rear projections or process shots, whatever, it was a pretty coarse-grained approach to making visuals. You watch a shot, some like film noir film, and two characters in a car driving along, and the the rear film, the rear window you can see is a rear projection, and everyone knows. You can tell what's going on. The story moves along, but you can see what's going on. Mm-hmm. With digital technologies, directors can now make seamlessly realistic environments, and they can do that from just replacing a sky or adding a flock of birds or a matte painting to a completely synthetic scene with thousands of space aliens tumbling down a hillside. It was an utter and total game changer.
Yeah, but I know Wakanda doesn't exist. Even though I wish it did. We know it's not real, but we accept it. And I'm wondering how it changes the industry, particularly when you talk about something like Toy Story, where we're replacing actors with these really amazing digitally created figures.
So, that's a really interesting point. And one of the counterpoints to that, so sure, there's something of a replacement there. But we see actors who are imbibing their on-screen characters, which are synthetic in many cases, with the same perceptive acting talent that the actor would bring to a stage if it were a live-action shoot. So, and one of the things that's really interesting. So, I'm sure you or many of your guests have seen films that have been overdubbed. If you ever watch a film, an animated feature like Toy Story or any of the animated features, and you watch it in a different language, watch it in French, for example, the credit crawl is still that the actors who are voicing those characters, they're still there. It's the same acting talent that's behind the visualization, the visual characterization. If it's overdubbed, yes, even though it's a different voice. Okay. Exactly. But for example, one of the points I was going to make is that we have entirely computer generated characters. I'm thinking of the film Avatar, Zoe Saldana or Andy Serkis as Gollum.
That's what I was thinking.
And just tremendous performances. And those performances simply wouldn't be as compelling if it weren't for the talent of the actors.
So what are the drawbacks? What are the cons to using CGI? Any sense about that yet?
Wow. So that's a really interesting question. So I think there are a couple of things come to mind. I think one of the there is a potential for overkill. There's a potential for maybe this is just personal preference. I really enjoy visual effects work that is invisible, that helps propel the narrative forward, but doesn't necessarily register as something foreign or synthetic in the film. And I think there can be a tendency to just kind of overload with visual noise, visual, you know, like we can do it, so let's do it. Mm-hmm. That's one thing. I will also say recently there is there's been a lot of advancement, and not so much in the hand directed CG of motion pictures, but in machine learning and artificial intelligence and you know those aspects of digital content creation, and it's now becoming quite reasonable. I wouldn't say quite easy yet, but reasonable to create synthetic scenes or to mix and match individual characters that wouldn't have been mixed so easily just a few years ago. I'm thinking specifically there were some animations that they got passed around on the internet recently of who was it? It was Keanu Reeves as Forrest Gump. And so, you know, so there's Tom Hanks sitting on the park bench eating chocolates, and he turns his head around. It's actually Keanu Reeves, and this was all done with machine learning. So I think as far as technological advancement, that's impressive. But I think the broader risks to society are I think pretty clear, and I think we're just seeing the beginnings of that.
You mean where we cannot tell true fact from fiction, and what is that?
Sure.
You know, that people can start to manipulate what we see, and in any ordinary kind of case, like the news.
Yeah, well, that's it exactly. So I've spent more time than I should probably admit looking at the fine minutia of you know film grain or sensor noise and matching computer images to so that things seamlessly blend in and they become unrecognizable. I think it's kind of dangerous at a societal level if looking at an image, if judging whether an image is real or synthetic or not, requires that kind of expertise.
Hmm. You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about computer-generated imagery. My guest is Scott Frankel. He's Vice President of Technology at Avametric Gerber Technology. He oversees 3D applications, research and development, and is also votes for the Oscars because of his experience in many, many movies doing this very thing. If you have a question or comment for Scott Frankel, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I have to admit, you're talking to someone who saw Avatar 3 times in 3D. because I thought it was so fabulous and fantastic and amazing. I know they're using it as well in amusement parks now, right? I mean, it's a big part of that experience too.
Yes, yes, yes. So, you said you saw it in 3D. Oh, actually,
3 times.
I guess 3 times. I actually have to come clean. I think I only saw it twice. But it was a tremendous experience. And in 3D, there's when you can approach the synthetic environment that is so rich and so lush, the mm-hmm. production design was awe-inspiring. But then the 3D, if it's if you're lucky enough to see it in a theater that has really dialed in their 3D projection well, it can be a wonderfully immersive experience, and it's just it helps. Oh, the imagery just supports the narrative in transporting the audience to this different world, to this different place, and it's really exciting.
When can it get in the way? Some people thought that maybe the new Lion King overdid it. What do you think?
Oh, I haven't seen the new Lion King.
I haven't
so I
either.
Can't speak to that. Yeah. All right. I can't speak to that example. When mm-hmm. can it get in the way? Well, you know, I referenced earlier that the simple fact that you can do something doesn't necessarily mean that you should do something. There's a wonderful magic that you get when you have constraints. So, for example, you know, in the original E.T. film, Steven Spielberg's E.T. from the mid 70s, there is E.T. was the character was puppeteered. It was you kind of jokingly referred to as a puppet on a trash can with wheels. And you know, it was moved around the stage, but you never saw the footfalls. You never saw E.T. actually walking. And there's something I think really magical about when you bring together really bright people, really creative people, and you give them limitations. It's like, okay, so you can't see the footfall. How are we going to handle this? You can come up with I think you're forced to actually just double down on your creativity to come up with a solution that is going to be as compelling as you would have liked to have done if you had all of the tools, all of the techniques available to you. And I think the outcome of that is oftentimes richer because we're being pushed to limits that we don't, being pushed to solutions that we wouldn't ordinarily come to on our own.
In one of the new Star Wars movies, they brought Carrie Fisher back to life as a CGI Princess Leia. How did you feel about that?
How did I feel about that? Well, as a character and as a real life person in the world, Carrie Fisher was just a wonderful wonderful person. Mm-hmm. There's something a bit odd about seeing her in the film as a young person. If it had been archival footage, B-roll that they had slugged, that they had cut into the film, then that would have had a different tone to it. It's interesting. There are the ability. So on one side, it's a little odd. On the other side, it did help propel the story and it helped the filmmakers tell their narrative. And so that's a positive. So, I guess there are two sides of the coin. I want to remember Carrie Fisher in the most positive light possible. And I want to see filmmakers be able to have all of the tools at their disposal to tell the stories that they want to tell. Yeah, but it's odd.
Yeah. Do you think, I'm wondering about what's next for CGI and how do you think we're going to adapt to it? We're going to find it less odd over time or what's next and how are we going to deal with that?
Sure. Yeah. So what's next? So I think that, I think there are a couple of things that are happening. One is that there's, the tools, the techniques, the processes are becoming easier. So filmmakers just have more at their disposal. One of the trends that I think that we're going to be seeing is, in effect, less CG or less visible CG. For example, let me give you a concrete example. Last year's Oscar-winning film for Best Visual Effects was First Man, right? Damien Chazelle's film about Neil Armstrong landing on the moon. Mm-hmm. And there are two things about that film that I think really stood out for me visually. And I think was ultimately deserving of the award. And the two things were, first of all, taking the archival footage that was captured in the day, all these engineering cameras and whatnot that were used to document the launch and troubleshoot it or get improved processes, et cetera. All that footage was remastered in effect. changing, embellishing, adding, et cetera. That could not have been easy work. That was probably painstakingly difficult, and added a sense of dynamism and realism to the film that I think was that really paid off. The other, I think, is a fascinating example of how visual effects were used, and I think is something of a maybe presage a trend that moves forward, which is that instead of creating entirely synthetic scenes of the launches and the point of view, the astronauts' point of view of their experiences, the filmmakers created an enormous digital LED screen, projected footage onto it, and then put their actors in that environment. And so all of the really subtle lighting effects, the shadows, the glints in eyes, the reflections, all that stuff is real and captured on film because it was projected onto them. And I just think that was a fascinating approach and really takes the digital into the realm where actually if the digital can become practical, then you can yield even more compelling results.
You mean like when you say practical, you mean affordable because it has to be still pretty expensive.
Oh. Yes, right. No, sorry. Yeah, still pretty expensive. When I say practical, so in effects work, there's a division between a digital effect and a practical effect. So, for example, in Jurassic Park, a whole bunch of Gallimimus dinosaurs running by a tree, a branch of the tree breaks. Well, that was a practical effect. That was someone pulling that twig down with a little cable. And then the digital effects were all the dinosaurs running through.
Ross, I'm sorry. Scott Frankel, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate your time today.
It's an absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me on the show.
Scott Frankel is Vice President of Technology at Avametric Gerber Technology, where he oversees 3D applications, research and development. He's a voting member of the Academy of Motion Pictures Arts and Sciences, and he has 25 visual effects credits for movies such as Minority Report, one of my favorites, The Matrix sequels, all of them mine favorites, Planet of the Apes, Forrest Gump, and many more. More Tech Tuesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Nintendo is rolling out a new version of the Switch, officially called the Nintendo Switch Lite, L-I-T-E. The Switch Lite comes out this Friday. Critics are already praising its smaller, more colorful, and convenient design. Russell Holley is a contributing editor for Android Central. He joins us to talk about that more. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So it's more colorful, it's better, what can we look forward to?
Okay, so look, this is like a weird sticking point for me. I don't complain about this kind of stuff often, but it bugs me that phones only come out in like the same three boring colors.
Yeah, no, you mentioned that many times.
Yeah, like I try not to rail on it a whole lot, but it's the thing that bugs me. And the Nintendo Switch came out and it was this kind of like flat gray and you could attach colors to the sides of it.
Yeah.
But then they released this Switch Lite and it comes in four really cool colors. I'm totally buying a bright yellow one, and
okay.
I'm not sad about it. but yeah, it comes out in colors. This is clearly designed for a younger audience, kids who are less likely to, and me, kids who are less likely to stick to a television, or, adults who are just not doing a lot of playing games in the living room. People who, very rarely connect to the television, or they just, are mobile all the time, and this is, bigger than a phone. It has more games than you would normally play on a phone. And so the controllers don't come off of this model. It doesn't have, kind of the weird disassembling thing that the original Switch does. And it's a slightly bigger design in that it's a little thicker. It can survive a drop or two a little better than the original version. And it's $100 cheaper than the original model.
How so? I mean, how can that be?
So there, it's just less tech that goes into it. Like the removable parts, like engineering, that is expensive.
Okay.
And they're using a new display technology called IGZO, which stands for four things that I'm not going to say out loud because y'all already think I'm a big enough dork. And it's a less expensive screen technology and supposedly a better battery. The battery thing is something that requires a little more testing, though.
Is it conceivable that they found that people weren't removing the controls and it wasn't as much of a desirable aspect?
They definitely found that there are a group of people who don't do that, but it's very, I think it's pretty evenly split actually between people who enjoy that kind of multiplayer aspect, especially when it comes to multiple kids in a car, who are able to kind of, split the controllers and play together on long drives and things like that. That's been something that Nintendo has repeatedly said is something that has been deeply enjoyed. But there's also just a group of people who wanted this nice portable console that was kind of an evolution from our Game Boy days or our Nintendo DS days. And that's exactly what this is.
All right, so you mentioned yellow. What are the other cool colors?
There is a teal. There is a silver that has custom etchings on the back for two Pokemon that are coming out in the version of Pokemon Sword and Shield that comes out next month, whose names are Zacian and Zamazenta, I think.
Good, Russell.
and then there's a lighter, kind of grayer model that is for people who aren't as excited about colors as I am.
Well, I don't get the teal. That must be something. I don't get the teal thing. It's not a favorite, but I want a nice bright blue. So when that happens, maybe I'll jump into Switch.
There you go.
There is a more powerful Switch console on the way with no release date.
Well, so this has not been officially confirmed by Nintendo, but there's been a lot of speculation about something called a Switch Pro. And the Switch Pro is something that would, in theory, be a more powerful version of the current Nintendo Switch, be able to handle possibly 4K gaming or 1080p gaming when you are mobile. And that's something that excites people who prefer that kind of Xbox-style gaming where there's a focus on realism and not so much a focus on, fun. But that is something that is probably expected for sometime next year.
You know, there are probably some people listening, Russell, that have literally never gamed ever. Could you summarize how big this stuff is now and why we include it so often on the show?
It's sure.
Huge.
Yeah, I mean, not a problem at all. The biggest indicator that I can point to is Minecraft. Earlier this week, is a game that has been available for just about everything. Is now actively the most played game in the entire world with 114 million weekly active players. So it is something that is
one
massive.
Game.
That's one game. Esports games regularly fill out entire sports stadiums when they host tournaments. There are games of Fortnite and PUBG that are streamed online that regularly compete with Netflix streams as far as how many people are watching it concurrently. Gaming is a very big deal. It has become a global phenomenon, not just for people who enjoy sitting, but also for people who enjoy watching and participating in very different ways than just, picking up a controller.
So amazing. Dell Chromebook, you wanted to talk about that, the 3100 2-in-1. What's going on?
Yeah, so Dell does this really interesting thing with Chromebooks where they're usually aimed for education, where teachers often can pick up Dell Chromebooks at a considerable discount, and they offer a lot, just kind of a nicer feeling Chromebook for people who don't maybe want to maintain a solid Windows laptop and maybe don't want to pay what you would normally pay for a MacBook. So these are usually something that are available pretty exclusively to teachers, but this version is actually a publicly available thing. It's a $360 laptop, which it does not sound like a lot because it's not. And what you get is a laptop that, does the folding thing so that you can, have it as a tablet to kind of watch movies and things on when you need it to. But also just a nice, smallish laptop that has a great keyboard on it. Dell has always been pretty good with keyboards. But also ports on the side that connect to more than just, a single thing. There's a lot of kind of smaller, lighter laptops recently that have been designed with individual ports in mind. So maybe the oval port for USB Type-C, like you'll see in MacBooks now or iPads. That single port is usually enough for charging and usually enough for like maybe music or something. But students and teachers often need more things. If you're connecting to a projector or if you're connecting a thumb drive or connecting to a printer or things like that and don't have the ability to do so wirelessly, having those extra ports is it saves you from buying another thing that you have to carry around all the time. So this is a really great design for that kind of classroom experience.
And, you know, when we're talking about classroom, I mean, a lot of kids are using computers at the grade school level now. In fact, you know, as many that can do it. So at the price point you're talking about, I'm thinking it's also a great starter computer.
Yeah, that's been Dell's mission for the last year. They've actually spoken about this several times, is that because Chromebooks have been so successful in classrooms, Dell's trying to create Chromebook environments for when kids leave school, when they need that first laptop because they're entering high school or college or something like that. And the thing that they've used almost the entire time they've been in school has been a Chromebook. This is the thing that they are most familiar with. This is the thing they're most comfortable with. And so Dell is trying to position these laptops, both for students and teachers, to be able to continue using that experience that they are familiar with from school.
Now, hasn't Apple been trying to break into this market?
Apple has been trying very hard to break into this market, and so has Microsoft has been trying to regain dominance in this market with the Surface Go and with the iPad, respectively. And there's been very little success. You know, the pricing for a lot of those things is often a little more than the Chromebooks, and price is ultimately what it comes down to for a lot of school districts. When you can buy 50 Chromebooks for the price that you would buy 30 iPads, there's just not a lot of math there.
Well, why do you think that Microsoft and Apple can't get it together and manage this?
Because the biggest thing that Google is making money on is not actually the hardware, it's the services, and that's not something that Apple and Microsoft can claim. You know, Google wants to be able to not just sell the Chromebooks, they want to be able to sell the entire suite of docs and presentations and things like that, the entire work suite, so that you're doing everything in Google's environment. And that's an ecosystem lock-in that Google has been able to very successfully pitch to these companies. Whereas, you know, Apple doesn't really have a school-friendly version of its entire portfolio. And Microsoft, the best that they can do is offer a handful of it for free, but then they have support things that they want you to be able to pay for when you are at that enterprise level.
It's interesting. You think they can do anything, but they can't. and the idea that it's marketed for students, it makes me wonder. I mean, how they design computers and laptops and tablets for specific purposes, and what goes into that. I mean, I'm wondering, is there a lot of people or a few people or what?
Yeah, I'm sure that there's a lot of that goes into this. And one of the cool things about the Chromebook ecosystem is that a lot of it comes directly from feedback from teachers now, especially. You know, Google has an entire classroom initiative where it's, what thing here is useful. And that's one of the biggest reasons why a lot of Chromebooks that do this two-in-one flip thing actually have digital pens built in, so that, writing and note-taking and things like that can actually be a part of the experience, which a lot of teachers, very aggressively asked for.
When you say digital pens, you mean your fingertip or actual, what do you call it?
Like a proper stylus that
slides out of the
body of the laptop.
Okay.
Yeah, and in a lot of cases, that's something that has been really useful, especially when it comes to digital note-taking.
Okay. Marvel. You wanted to talk about the new Marvel Dimension of Heroes game on the Lenovo Mirage AR. Tell us about it.
So this is actually the evolution of another thing that came out a couple years ago. There was this Star Wars related thing where you grabbed a lightsaber and you put this funny looking headset on and you could swing the lightsaber around and battle things in augmented reality. And this was cool for two reasons. One, it wasn't like a full lightsaber, so you didn't have to worry about, breaking something by, swinging this giant stick. It was just the handle. But when you put the headset on, you could actually see the whole lightsaber because it was augmented reality. But it was a transparent headset instead of something that completely covers your eyes. So you're also not accidentally smacking someone in the head, which is important and something that I get wrong too often in virtual reality. The evolution here is moving with Disney from the Star Wars franchise over to Marvel. And this is being able to play as Thor or Black Panther or Captain Marvel in a lot of different games, both as a single player and cooperative if you have another person who has one of these headsets. And it's unfortunately not as good as the Star Wars version. Part of that is just because of age. The headset has not really improved over the last 2 years. And so there are some, it's just kind of complicated to set up. It's not the kind of thing that I would confidently give to my sister or my mom and say, here, try this thing out, because it's kind of, you know, tricky to set up and get right. And then, you know, making sure that it doesn't, you know, make you, you know, drift off in one direction or another is kind of complicated. And it's also kind of expensive. It's $250 just for this one thing that only plays this one game.
Now, explain to me again, what do you mean by age? What does that have to do with? You mean the age of the hardware?
Yeah, the age of the hardware. This is the headset itself. You know, this is the same hardware that was for the Star Wars thing 2 years ago.
Okay.
And you know, the thing 2 years ago had some tracking problems that got a little better with software. But this is the exact same experience. They haven't really done anything to improve that. But at the same time, they've increased the price. The Jedi Challenges headset was $200 when it came out, and this is $250. And it's worth pointing out that the Jedi Challenges headset, which is the exact same hardware, in most places like Best Buy, is only like $70 now.
Why? What do you make of this decision not to upgrade that?
You know, Lenovo is the company that powers, you know, kind of the hardware end of this. And I think that it I think it comes down to, you know, a decision that this was probably good enough, which in my opinion was the wrong decision. Mm-hmm. And there were some improvements made to other things. Obviously, the controllers, you're not swinging a lightsaber. You're using two different controllers that mount to your hands. And those are very nice. But the headset itself just still has a lot of problems.
As far as augmented reality games, do you see them getting more and more popular, or just people just going right to virtual reality and bypassing this?
There's a lot of excitement surrounding augmented reality, especially when it comes to the idea that you'd be able to put on these glasses that look like totally normal glasses and be able to just kind of play games. We're obviously very far from that reality. This mm-hmm. this headset is bulky. It weighs 1 pound, and all the weight is forward. That's before you put the computer into it, so it's actually a little more. And it definitely does not look like a normal pair of glasses. it definitely looks like a goofy headset that has glowing lights coming out of it, and you kind of look like a monster while you're wearing it. But the promise of that, you know, the future world where you're able to kind of play these games and you know, kind of have it look semi-normal and you know, be able to play in the same space as other people is the thing that I think gets a lot of people very excited. But we're still a couple of years from that being reality. So for right now, VR headsets are the thing that I usually recommend.
You wanted to talk about Apple Watch Series 5 aluminum versus titanium watch. You said don't buy the titanium Apple Watch. What's the problem? Who cares?
It is pointlessly expensive. You go to any watch store and you buy a titanium version of a watch, there's usually like a $50 or $60 difference for one of those watches. And there, it's not like Apple's using a special version of titanium or anything like that. It's a titanium body, which is cool, you know, especially if you are prone to smacking your wrist into things like I am, and I have definitely scuffed my existing Apple Watch a couple of times. So having titanium is definitely beneficial from a durability perspective, but it is twice the price of the aluminum version. The normal Apple Watch is already kind of pricey at $400,
mm-hmm.
but the titanium version doesn't have any other special insides. It's just the titanium body, and it is $400 more.
Wow.
So it is, you know, like there's no way that is worth $800 for titanium versus aluminum, aside from you know, Apple felt like they could get away with that price for the new body. So I'm a fan of the Apple Watch Series 5. I think that they've done a lot of really cool things and made the ability to keep the screen on is kind of table stakes at this point. But definitely, if you're looking at the different body options, I would not recommend the titanium version. There are just better ways to spend that money.
Do they come out with different bands, or is that kind of irrelevant these days because you can get so many other brands for the bands?
Yeah, Apple makes so many different bands that and you can get them third party from so many other places that's not really as big a deal. What you're really paying for here is the body. Swapping out the bands is the same on any watch, or any Apple Watch rather.
And titanium or aluminum, are they brushed metal or are they polished?
These are going to be brushed, you know, and they look fantastic. You know, obviously the titanium is a little darker and comes in, you know, more than one color. Although it's worth pointing out that the titanium version does not have a gold version, if you are excited about having a gold Apple Watch. Really, if you're looking for something that's just slightly nicer than the aluminum one, I would just say go with the steel version. The steel version is also very durable and comes in, you know, some other nicer designs and is not $400 more.
Wow. You're right. That's crazy. Russell Holley, thanks a lot for your insights. As always, appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
That's Russell Holly, Android Central Contributing Editor. And that's it for Tech Tuesday today. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.